Alaskans start going out fishing and Congress starts looking at its money bills. Senator Mark Begich will head back to Washington shortly, but he's here to talk with Alaskans today. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The number to speak with Senator Begich is 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. Friday, he was looking at the Shell drilling ship. This afternoon, he's talking drones. And right now, he's on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Providence Imaging Center, helping your medical provider secure access to imaging results online so they can view your report quickly, whether you were seen in Eagle River, Anchorage, or Soldotna. Learn more at provimaging.com. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has over 70 job openings available statewide in nursing, social work, and child protection. There's nothing more important than protecting the health and well-being of Alaska families, so take the first step towards a meaningful career. Visit dhss.alaska.gov and click on Careers. Join their team and make a difference every day. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
And our guest is Senator Mark Begich. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Senator.
Thank you very much. It was tight getting here, but we just finished meeting with a group of small business people and at the mall and yesterday in Fort Yukon and in Fairbanks. So it's been a whirlwind already.
And you were in what,
Petersburg, Ketchikan,
you were in
Seattle
Friday.
Friday, and then Ketchikan, and then Petersburg. And I think Thursday we'll be in the valley in Wasilla. And then Thursday late night, I got to fly back. So full schedule.
And boy, the life of a senator.
I joke with people. They say, well, it must be so luxurious. I said, yeah, I last night I had a chili dog from Dairy Queen on the way in at 10 o'clock at night because that was the only time. And earlier in the day, I had a $2.99 wrapped up something. I'm not sure what it was, but I ate it. So well, it's all part of the way the world goes.
Well, yeah. I did want to I'm kind of thinking that Shell's permit time is coming close now.
Yes.
And you got a chance to have a look at their drill ship,
I guess,
down there in Seattle. I wanted to ask you about that.
Sure. It was pretty impressive. My second trip back to see their rig, but this time I was able to walk through it and really look at what they've done. You know, we've seen over the last year, Shell, the federal agencies, from the Coast Guard to the oil and gas folks, all those folks have come in and talked to us about the preparation they have and the sense of oil spill technology they put together. And this was the first time to actually walk through the rig and actually see what they were doing. And I have to tell you, it is impressive. I mean, they have two blowout preventers developed for the rig, which is unheard of in the oil and gas business, in a sense of having both those available on ship. They have an oil recovery system. They'll have 23 associated vessels with that single rig when it's up in the Arctic. They'll have over 600 employees. They will have, Coast Guard has initiated a effort to have the right kind of equipment up there when needed. This rig is also an ice capable rig. It worked up in the Beaufort many years ago, so it understand in the sense of how it's structured and developed to withstand ice and so forth. It was impressive. There's no question about it. They have totally refurbished. You know, people say, well, it's just that old rig. I said, well, no, you have to see what they've done. Everything from zero emissions coming out of that rig, the boiler systems, the heating systems, the power generation, all new, meeting all the EPA standards and exceeding the EPA standards in a sense of air quality. They'll be working at this point, it looks like July through September, and I think it's going to be a new renaissance for us up in the Arctic. Maybe oil and gas, but from exploration, but we have shipping and cruise ship industry is starting to look at what's going on up there. Science and technology, as you know, fishing is not allowed, but a lot of people are looking at what's the potential. So the trip to Seattle was short, but it was enough to walk through that rig. And I mean, it's hard to describe it because you walk in there and people say, well, it's just another ship. Well, not really. Not the way this is designed to withstand any of the Arctic conditions, as well as, even though it's in the summertime, it's still designed to meet the Arctic conditions in the wintertime.
Well, I'm sure you're aware of the New York Times article that showed up last week and got reprinted here, which essentially says you've been a significant political force in bringing the Obama administration around.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, now that it's pretty well assured and Romney pretty well has it in the bag, I sense that the that election year politics are very much hardening up. In other words, the administration, the Obama administration seeking re-election, is going to have to get itself positioned.
Right.
And this is like could be the big embarrassment. I mean, one really huge liability because there's so much adamant opposition.
Right. I guess I would say this, and I think your point about Romney is today he'll seal up the nomination of the Texas delegates that are going to come in and you know, this kind of pro forma. Now the engagement, you know, it started to occur. Now it really will occur. But here's an interesting, you know, I think the article, I give a lot of credit to the folks that put that article together. They really detailed out the stages of what has happened. And I remember, honestly, when I got elected, here's what people said. And they not only said it behind my back, they said it to me. And they said, with Obama in the presidency and a Democrat from Alaska, we'll never get anything done with regards to oil and gas ever again. Oddly enough, the place that we're having development and aggressive development is going to be in the federal waters. I mean, you think about the oil production of Chukchi and Beaufort, it could be close to 900,000 additional barrels a day going into that pipeline once in production in the next 10 to 15 years. But what we try to explain to the Obama administration is, look, you may not agree on oil and gas overall, but people like myself, born and raised in the state, we're not going to do it to harm our state. We're going to do it for the right reasons. And if there are higher standards that we have to have in Alaska, so be it. But let's make sure we create certainty and timetables. So in other words, the big pitch we always kept making to the administration was, there's never sure when this is ever going to end. In other words, the process. When's the process going to end? And then what do you want them to do? Tell them what you want them to do, and then they will go back to the drawing board and determine if that makes economic sense and if they have the technology to do it. I think what you see is Shell has said, we can do this under these conditions, even though they're the most extreme conditions in the sense of environmental standards compared to anywhere in the country. And I think that's great because the Arctic is a fragile area. We want to make sure it's done right. So I think in a lot of ways, the issues for the administration has been a broader issue. Matter of fact, this small business group I just left, two of the questions of the six or seven that were asked was gas prices. So it is incumbent upon the president's people to open up more areas for domestic production. You have to do that to create some more opportunity for us to buy our own product from our own country rather than buying it from countries that really despise us. And that's what we're doing right now, and it's getting us into wars and other things we shouldn't be engaged in.
Well, the article said that the administration was insistent on some real progress on renewables.
Absolutely.
And I would think that that the president, the administration, would be looking for your support on something along those lines.
They are, and I'm a, as you know, when I was mayor, we did a lot of things here on conservation. We tapped methane gas out of the landfill. We started that project. We did the largest light conversion project here in the nation when it came to bringing efficiencies in. I'm as much a supporter of making sure we have oil and gas as renewable energy, and I think in a lot of ways they look to us, and I say to my office, to me specifically, and say, you know, okay, we're doing oil and gas. What more can we do in the other arena? And I'm open, but at the same time, it's a whole package. In other words, you can't just when the start of the administration was just renewable only, it was like, well, you can't get to where we need to get, which is a diversified energy portfolio, without all of it on the table. And if you notice the last 18 months or so, especially his State of the Union, his phrase was all the above, everything on the table. But if you go back early on during the campaign, that wasn't the case. And I think what we tried to make clear, and the article talked about it, every time the president called me on something, I said, by the way, you know, and I went off to oil and gas.
Oh, yeah. And I'm sure you tried Anwar, too.
I did it all.
Didn't quite get that far.
Didn't get that far. But, you know, I'll take CD5 in that sense, National Petroleum Reserve, Chukchi and Beaufort as the first step. But the point we were trying to make with the president was, look, I hear you. The more diversified energy resources we have for this country, the better off we're going to be economically and from a national security perspective. But you can't ignore the vast resources we have in oil and gas and say, well, maybe someday. No, you should do them simultaneously. And I think at the end of the day, he got that message. And if you look, even when he was campaigning, when I saw him the first time in the summer of 08, I was pretty clear. And it was very, you know, it was a great meeting. It was only myself, at that time, Senator Obama and a couple other people in the room, and that was it, and had a great conversation about these issues. And what I tried to explain to him is it's not an either or. You know, people have made it that way. You're for climate change or you're for renewables, then you must be against oil and gas. I don't believe that. There's a balance. Now, there are some good development and there's some bad development, and you have to balance it carefully. And that has been my pitch to the administration from day one, is don't be bought into the old model of you're for it or you're against it. You should look at it all in the total. And we got some headway, and that New York Times article was pretty in-depth, which I thought was pretty interesting.
It was. 1-800-478-8255. Senator Mark Begich is our guest. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. You ready?
Absolutely.
All right, this one from Doug. He say, Steve, can you ask him about the progress of getting the funding to clean up the Japanese tsunami debris?
Oh.
And what the cleanup will entail? Jobs? How bad is it? Worse than Exxon Valdez? And, you know, you do know, of course, that Montague Island has got a bunch of stuff on there. And the Gulf of Alaska keeper is wondering, well, how are we going to get this cleaned off?
That's right.
And that's just the beginning, because there's also the plume of cesium in the ocean, and already some tuna that have been swimming through that stuff that are coming up a little more radioactive. Not dangerously radioactive, but still clearly there's radiation in the water.
Yeah, here's what we did. You know, it's very frustrating. I chair the Oceans Committee, subcommittee of the Commerce Committee, which deals with oceans, fisheries, Coast Guard, NOAA, Arctic, all, as you can imagine, all important to Alaska. And so we have been asking, the tsunami occurred, the earthquake occurred, tsunami occurred, didn't take rocket science to tell us it's coming, right? Over a year ago. Well, you know, ship shows up unannounced, right? A ghost ship, no one sees it somehow. And we got pretty aggressive. Last week we had a hearing. I was there as the chair of the committee. Then I had Senator Cantwell and Senator Snow, a Democrat and Republican there. And we pushed the issue of where is the plan from NOAA? Why have they not planned for this? And this is a different kind of disaster. It is, you know, usually a hurricane occurs, we see it. We're there right then. Earthquake occurs, we're there. We see it. This is a prolonged disaster. What I mean by that is it just continually builds up. And you can't say one specific moment is where you need to attack it. It's a constant. And so what we were pretty harsh, to be very frank with you, on the administration on last week. The response was very quick afterwards. The head of NOAA contacted me right away. Dr. Lipchenko said, what do we got to do? I said, well, you know, simple. You better get a plan, put some money toward it, and then utilize these groups that are out there right now, because they know the areas. They know the tides. They know a lot of the ground that we don't need a big federal agency to come in there and try to do this. We got great groups out there. Give them the resources they need, and they will make this happen. But they need to do it over the next couple of years, because it won't come one day. It will come over a period. So plan it, put some resources, and then clean up in that process, but also prevention. We know stuff is coming, so we don't have to wait for it to hit shore. What are the plans in that? Well, right away, we not only got Dr. Lipchenko from NOAA contacting us, Now, the White House contacted us. We told them they got to start sharing information because we know the satellite information is available. But NOAA's not getting that. So things are now starting to – honestly, I feel like last week we put our foot down pretty hard and the ground shook a little bit in the White House. And when you were on NPR carried it, CNN carried it, several of the major national networks carried this story. And when that happens in Washington, it's such a small world they respond. And so we're seeing some response now. We'll see what their plan is over the next 2 weeks. But it's pretty simple. Plan it, put some resource to it, do some prevention, and get on with the show.
All right. A bunch of calls coming in. Tom joins the program from Homer. But before, Tom, before I start with your question, I want to get one from another Tom in. And this is the same thing that the small business people were talking to you about this morning, Senator. Mm-hmm. Our fuel prices in Alaska, we're talking gasoline,
right?
with tankers, because of the Port Angeles refinery situation, actually being held up now in mm-hmm. Prince William Sound, and sometimes even returning with some cargo in them.
Some cargo.
It's just so weird for Alaskans to take a look at $4.50 or so for.
Well, and as you know, even more in rural Alaska, when I was out in Fort Yukon, I think it was $8 for gasoline, and I think they said $6+ for heating fuel. Very expensive. There's no single answer to solving, except I will tell you one area that we are highly focused on. There are too many speculators in the market of oil and gas. And what this means, I'll try to be very simple on this. There's a commodities exchange that manages oil and gas in the country, in the world. And here's how it works. If you're a freight company, airline industry, you buy a 6-month contract for fuel. So you got stability. So, you know, we don't go down to Alaska Airlines every day and find out tomorrow the price is tripled because they didn't get the right price. They buy them over a period of time, which is exactly how the market was supposed to work. 80% of the market several years ago, was bought by those folks. Now it's the reverse. 80% of the market is by speculators. So it's very simple. If you only have so many gallons available to purchase every day, barrels of oil in the world market, speculators come in and buy those contracts up. So then they're legitimate users, freight companies, airline industry, gas stations, whatever, try to buy it. Well, they can't because the speculators hold the supply. But unless you want to pay their ransom, and of course you have to because you got to move freight, so you pay these higher prices. So the speculation goes up. They estimate for every gallon of gas that you and I and your listeners put into their car, 56 cents is speculators. Unbelievable. So we have a piece of legislation to get speculators out unless you use it for end purpose, meaning, like I said, freight companies, so forth. We also asked the chairman of the Commodities Exchange to use their emergency powers to get the speculators out. And the third is, which is pretty extreme, this next one. We've joined, and I say I and other senators have joined a group suing over this issue because these speculators have no business in this market unless you're legitimately going to take it at the end of the contract for use in your business. Like I said, freight company, airline industry, whatever it might be. That's the right approach. We think that could be an immediate impact of 56 cents a gallon. Imagine that next time, and your listeners, next time, if they're right now sitting at the gas station filling up, listening to the radio, and when you see that gallon, you know, churning away, and you fill up 15 gallons or 10 gallons in your car, it's real money.
Well, you're sounding a lot like Ted Stevens used to erupt on this one.
This is like
it keeps coming back, so it'd be nice if something actually moved on.
Well, this one, here's what I kind of, you know, I hate to say this, this weekend, Memorial Day weekend, all these senators are going to come back come Monday, right? What do you think they're going to have heard all weekend? Gas prices. I'm like going, yay, now maybe we'll get some people who can join us. Because this is a no-brainer. Speculators should not be in this business if they do not utilize the fuel for purpose, meaning if they're just buying paper and they're preying on misery or they're just consuming the market to hold us, you know, wait for us consumers to pay the ransom, that is not why that commodities was set up.
All right, Tom joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Senator Mark Begich, Tom.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Yes.
I'd just like to say that I worked on the pipeline during the days when it was 60 below, and I've been in the Bering Sea when it was tough, where you had ice everywhere. And to say that you can go in the Arctic and start drilling and do it safely, you haven't been there if you believe that. Down in the Gulf of Mexico, they've got the fish all goofed up where you can't eat them. And they can't even control it where there's no ice. So there is no way to do it right in the Arctic. And if you read David Bloom's book on alcohol can be a gas, where the farmers provide the fuel, that's the best answer. That's all I got.
Well, let me, if I can, first, Tom, let me say this, that the Gulf and the Arctic are different. Pressures are different. Depths are different. Second, the technology in the late 80s, that's when the last activity was in the Beaufort and Chukchi. I actually have a great map in my office to show, because people also don't think anything ever was developed or explored in the Arctic. Well, yes, it was. As a matter of fact, if you look at the history, there were no spills or problems with that old technology back in the 80s. Things have advanced a great deal since then. The standards are much higher. The technology is much better. Now, we're also restricting them, that they can't do it in the thick ice periods. They have to do it July through about the third week, I think it is, in September. Very short season. I mean, that's not November, that's not December, that's not January, that's not February. But I do believe that, you know, and the Coast Guard has even said it, that they believe the technology and what Shell has done has far exceeded their expectations, and feel this will be a safe development compared to years ago with the technology that was available. But also, clearly, you know, the Gulf of Mexico is day and night compared to the Arctic in the sense of the technology utilization. Most of those places down there had, some of those had blowouts, in this case, blowout preventers. In this case, we have two blowout preventers for the drill rig. And along with that, equipment on site that was not available down the Arctic or down in the Gulf. So I, you know, I appreciate Tom's experience from the late 80s, but it's, you know, 20 plus years.
Tom, you want to put in your little pitch for renewables there? I thought I heard something about alcohol.
Oh, let me, good point. This is the thing with renewable energy, and I just fought a battle in the defense authorization bill, because the Defense Department is one of the largest developers of renewable, and they're doing some stuff around algae, biofuels, you name it. Well, we actually lost the battle on a 13-12 vote. Now the military will not be able to continue to do biofuel experiment and development, which is unbelievable, insane, actually, that they can't do this. They're the largest consumers of energy in this country. When you talk to the generals, why do we now have more compact solar panel mobile systems? It's not because us in this room or your listeners coming up with these ideas and saying, well, I want a more mobile system for my house. No, it's because the military actually worked with the industry to develop the most refined and small, compacted solar system that they could. Why? Because the Marines, when they're out in forward operating bases, they don't want to haul a bunch of batteries. They need it efficiently done. It was the military that has brought us to this stage. But to be frank with you, we have some, you know, knuckle draggers in the U.S. Senate that believe, you know, that we should just leave things as they are, and the private sector will just suddenly materialize this new technology. Well, GPS didn't occur because the private sector. That was because the military needed this technology. This computer system we have, we're here in this studio, and people who might be listening, that was by the military. They have the horsepower around energy on renewable energy projects. And for us to say to the military, we don't want you doing that anymore, is insane. It saves money, it's more efficient, and it saves lives in the military battlefield. So we have that battle ahead of us. But in regards to the technology of, we have to also be very careful that we don't displace food production with fuel production. And that means taking a product that might be utilized for food and then turning it into production for oil or fuel for our vehicles. But there is great technology out there. We're constantly advocating for it. So I'm a big fan of biofuels. I'm hydro, geothermal, you name it, I'm in it and want to see it. But as a member of the Armed Services Committee, I was very disappointed in some of the members' lack of understanding. And I'll be just frank with you, these guys have been there too long. They see things like they were in the 50s, and we're not there anymore.
Tom and Homer, I'm gonna go ahead and cut you off and pursue this military thing a bit more with the senator. Thanks for your call, Tom. We seem to have this odd standoff on defense spending right now, with the House actually wanting more spending.
Right.
Secretary Panetta and his Air Force insisting that, saying, look, we have no choice. We have to make all these cuts. And one of them, of course, involves Austin and those F-16s. And I think the report's going to be out, right, in just a few days?
It should be out by the end of this week is what they've told us. And that's after a meeting I had with General Schwartz, who's the chief of staff to the Air Force. You know, we have been asking for this, you know, for weeks, if not months at this point now. We're happy to have the debate. If they're going to say Eielson will save money, then show me, you know, as they say, show me the money. You know, show me what your savings. Here's what's amazing about this. Last week, beginning of the week, they told me in 2013, it will save $3.5 million for 2013. Okay. Midweek, when General Schwartz came to see me, it was going to cost $9 million in 2013. By the end of the week, it was $20 million it was going to cost us for 2013. So this has been my point. Show me the information. Quit moving the ball around. And then we'll have the debate over savings. If they want to know where savings are, I'm happy to show them, as I've done over and over again. For example, this one system, it's a weapon system called MEADS. When I first got onto this issue, the Army doesn't want it. Our partners are barely going to use it. We're paying 75% of it. And oh, by the way, it doesn't work. And oh, by the way, the reason we're not going to get it is because it doesn't work. $800 million, right? So I advocated getting rid of this. And they said, well, it would cost us $824 million to cancel it. This was 2 years ago. So we should just finish it to concept because that's only $800 million. And I thought, you know, every contract is subject to appropriation. That's the law. So just cancel it by not giving the money. It's pretty simple, right? So what did we do? We tried this. We couldn't get enough support. Last year, we did get support. Defense Authorization Committee, the Armed Services Committee I sit on, eliminated that. Appropriators put it back in. So now we're back at it again this year. Now instead of $800 million or last year's potential savings of $600 million, now it's only $400 million. Why? Because we've been writing checks for this thing that we're never going to use. So this year, I went on my rant again, got the Defense Committee to agree, but we got another language this time that requires the appropriators on the Appropriation Committee, they can't go putting this money back in no matter how hard the company comes and lobbies them because we're not going to use it. It's a waste of money. So if the Defense Department wants to have a debate over savings, like the $500 million they wasted on a payroll system that they actually failed to implement and never went after the contractor for a recourse, I'd be happy to do that. But if they're going to tell me that the F-16s need to be moved because it's going to save money, but in 1 week it goes from a $3.5 million savings to a $20 million cost for 2013, I have a lack of confidence in their ability to manage savings.
I would think that they'd find some way of making this report that's about to come out show that there would be savings, though.
Oh, they will. I guarantee you they will.
Yeah.
But here's some of the things they said. For example, okay, we're going to move all these people to Anchorage. Hundreds. The problem with that is they said the housing is no problem here. Well, unless they've missed something, the vacancy rate is around 2.5% here in the rental market. You will move the rates up very quickly for the existing renters by that influx. And they say, well, maybe we'll need to reexamine that. Well, yeah, because your impact this year, right, you might get a good rate on the rent, but next year, because the market will be so tight, they're going to pay more. So all we're asking for, and that's why I've held this general's promotion, and I've talked to the general. I know him and Hawk Carlisle, and I've had him over at my house for dinner, and I said, you know, Hawk, you're just caught in the crossfire here. I apologize, but at the end of the day, he understands what we're trying to do. We just want the information. After that, he can move on with his promotion, and then we'll have the debate over the facts, not this moving ball they keep doing.
It's Talk of Alaska with Senator Mark Begich as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
It's Talk of Alaska with Senator Mark Begich, 1-800-478-8255, in the studio live in Anchorage, 550-8422, a local call, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Why, a stack of calls from Homer, but I'm going to get this Anchorage one okay. in now. Sylvia, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you very much, and good morning. I would like to say that our health care system offered here at the VA, our Alaskan VA, tends to be very good. But I wanted to encourage Senator Begich to check into what we could do about getting...
I'm missing her.
I don't know.
Get her.
Sylvia.
Sylvia, we lost you.
Oh.
Say it again. Okay. Now you're back.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
To check into, and then you stopped. Uh-oh.
Oh, we've got loss of signal.
What?
Ask your question.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I would like to encourage Senator Begich to check into more funding, perhaps for the support staff hiring. There are a lot of doctors there, and everyone's overworked. But some of the doctors are doing, or many of the doctors are doing, a lot of things that normally secretarial or medical assistants could do, and if there were more support staff, the doctors would be freer to see more patients, and it's cheaper to hire support staff than it is to hire doctors to do that sort of work.
Oh, yeah, so doctors are expensive. The senator's nodding his head.
Yeah,
Sylvia.
I agree. Sylvia, this is a great point. One of the things we've argued, and I sit on the Veterans Committee, and we've been successful in moving the VA budget up. Literally 30 plus billion over the last 3 years. But saying that, the area that we've asked them to continue to focus on is two parts. It's a back office support staff, which includes physician assistants and nurses too. Because, as you know, a lot of the work, especially lab work and other work like that, are from physician assistants, from nurses, and that support staff that then accompanies them, we think is a very important piece. The other part of this, we just had a historic agreement about 2 weeks ago signed, which is very important. It's in the roadless system of Alaska. And basically, like, for example, I was in Fort Yukon yesterday, beautiful new clinic. But if you're a veteran in Fort Yukon and you want to use your VA benefits, maybe to get just your checkup, your annual or whatever it might be, you cannot use that facility. You have to come into Anchorage to the clinic. Instead, now, an agreement we help broker allows the veteran to go to that clinic. They can still go to Anchorage if they want, or Seattle, wherever their services are. But if they decide they just want to go across the street, they can do that. And then the VA will reimburse the clinic 100%. This is a huge. We have 16 organizations across the state now have signed up. This will be a huge impact in a positive way for veterans on the roadless system. So I hear you. And one thing we also just got, we had veterans on telemedicine, which is a very powerful tool to deliver mental health services and other minor things, that we got the VA to agree with us that they don't need to have a copay on that because it's actually very efficient and saves them money. And then you can use services all around the country, not just here in Anchorage. They just changed that. That's going to start going into play now, that copays will no longer be required for telemedicine services of certain categories, which I think is great. But you're absolutely right on the back office, and I will definitely follow up. I'd be curious And I will ask this question to my VA staff members. What's the ratio, and what does that compare, and what do we need to do? But I you're right on.
Yeah, you know, we fought so hard to get that facility for so long, and the idea that it's not it can't operate at peak efficiency because of lack of support personnel, that's very distressing.
Exactly, yeah. And it's a wonderful facility.
It is.
But that would be my suggestion. The other item, I would like to encourage renewable energy, and I'm a big supporter of Senator Begich, but I have been strongly against the offshore drilling. I really hated to see the push for that due to it's such a great risk to take. And, you know, nothing is foolproof, and it's just too much of a risk, in my opinion. So I wanted to put that in. But, again, I appreciate your work with the VA. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sylvia. One thing I should say, too, you know, after whatever happens this summer with the development in the Arctic, as the chair of the Ocean Subcommittee, we're going to have a hearing that brings all the players, the Coast Guard, Shell, and everything, to the table in a public forum to say what happened, what went right, what went wrong, you know, kind of lay it out. Because I think part of our job, and I say ours collectively, the Senate, and my job specifically in the Oceans Committee, is oversight. You know, we just shouldn't say, go do it, and 3 years later go, oh, my God, what happened, because we didn't pay attention. So literally a month and a half after the completed work in the Arctic, I intend to have a hearing for the simple purpose of oversight. What happened? What did we do? What lessons did we learn? What are some of the gaps? I've asked the Coast Guard at the beginning of this process in the Arctic to think of every resource they're going to use here and what advantage or disadvantage, meaning did they move resources from another part of the state or the country that had a gap now because of that? All that information, so we have some baseline to work from. But instead of, again, waiting for some crisis to occur, we intend to have a pretty strong hearing to put all the players at the table and do some oversight.
There is an awful lot, and it keeps changing. But, I mean, that whole idea of using the reinforced buoy tenders to have an ice-resistant vessel that the Coast Guard can actually be on
scene
up there, it needs to be followed up to see how that ends up working.
Right.
And just last Thursday, there was a tabletop spill response exercise where they essentially went to dispersants and burning.
Right.
You know, and I'm probably the North Slope people in Mount Rubel would not be real happy.
They're
about
not excited about that. But that's why you have to do this oversight. And again, we could wait 2-3 years down the road, but why not do it right after the season so everything's fresh in people's mind and bring all the players, you know, not just the oil company, but also the Coast Guard and NOAA and others who participate in this decision and get their public feedback on it, which I think is helpful, but also creates that transparency that people need to have with this type of development.
Well, it's an election year, and we've talked about Pentagon, we've talked about defense budget, we've talked about the F-16s, but there seems to be yet more with the NDAA. Kelly, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Senator Begich.
Thanks for taking my call, Steve. Hey, Senator Begich.
Yes.
I'm curious. I called your office, as I called Senator Murkowski's office, on the troubling section for the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, and was told point blank by your staff and by Senator Murkowski's staff that basically I was crazy, that what I said was in the bill, which turned out to be Section 1021, wasn't in there, that Americans couldn't be held indefinitely without trial or charge under this indefinite detention clause. And now we've got Catherine Forrest basically taking my side and saying, oh, yes, it was in there. And she just is a U.S. district judge that just ruled that Section 1021 violates the First Amendment and the Fifth Amendment and is facially unconstitutional. And I'm sure Obama's probably going to sue on this. But, you know, this is extremely troubling. And I also think, as a supporter of yours, this was a golden opportunity for you to shore up people on the other side, Tea Party folks, possibly. Because I know in talking to your office and Murkowski's office, overwhelming were the calls that came in with people concerned about this. It wasn't even close. Nobody was calling to say, yes, we need indefinite detention of American citizens without charge or trial. And I'd like to get your comments on Judge Catherine Forrest's ruling.
Yeah, first, I want to make one comment. I doubt someone in my office said you were crazy, but I think they probably disagreed with your position. And I know we made a lot of commentary on this. We've put some stuff on our webpage as well as on our Facebook laying out what that section, as well as the issue around U.S. citizens and indefinitely detained. But let me say this, that if the courts rule there's problems on the constitutionality, I don't have any problem in dealing with that. Matter of fact, Senator Udall, Mark Udall, intends to bring some stuff on the floor at later this year when the defense authorization bill comes before us, and I'm happy to take a look at what he's offering. I told him that, and if it addresses the issue of the constitutionality that's now the courts are questioning, then I'm happy to take a look at it. But let me also say that the comment about shoring up, a base or getting Tea Party people to be more amenable to me, here's a problem with our system, to be very frank with you right now. It's a responsive system versus at times you need to be clearly responsive, no question about that. But you also need to lead on certain issues and take positions. And in my case, if I sat around and just said, well, I got 10,000 calls on one side only, and that's the only way I should go, without looking at all the facts, I can show you multiple issues that may vary. And I can tell you, if you go back in history of things like Social Security and Medicare, polls were not supportive of those issues. So I hear what you're saying on the broader sweep. I'm happy to look. I told Mark Udall this last week in the defense authorization markup that we were doing, and he's working on some issues right now. Matter of fact, several senators are working on issues, and I'm happy to take a look at them.
Kelly, sounds like the pressure has been building a bit on this one.
Well, I want to also correct something. Let me just be clear. Both your office staff and Murkowski's office staff were extremely respectful. No one called me crazy. I was paraphrasing.
Okay, I just want to make sure.
Thank you.
No. The conversations we engaged in, they assured me that this language that Senator Begich, Senator Murkowski would never vote to have this. And I guess I've got to ask you, because it seems like in Congress, whether it's trialing Al-Qaeda people in New York under non-military tribunals, why are we so afraid of, if someone's accused of being a terrorist, why can't they have their day in court rather than the government, with Section 1021 now in force, being able to sweep people up because of associations? In fact, the plaintiff in this is Christopher Hedges and Noam Chomsky that report on these things and have contacts with these people and were concerned about their ties and being swept up. And in fact, in her decision, Catherine Forrest basically said that when she contacted the government's lawyers and asked them if a journalist could be held without charge or trial indefinitely, could they give assurances that that wouldn't happen? And the government could not in several different instances where she asked them. So I guess I'm like, do you believe in trial?
Kelly,
there in the Congress?
Yeah, Kelly, you can always review the plays after the fact. I will tell you, based on the information we received, based on Senator Levin, who is a strong civil rights supporter and rational, and the review that they had, now the courts are making decisions. I mean, you and I could have this argument on health care right now, too, that, okay, it wasn't, in my view, according to some judges that said it was unconstitutional. That's not the review we got at the time we passed it. Now it's in the Supreme Court. So the judicial process is now moving forward on this issue. When we passed it, it was very clear in my mind, based on the advice and the information we received, that it did not have a constitutionality problem. Now, we can always say, well, look now. Well, yes, now a single court, a judge has made a determination. Now we're looking at it. I hear you.
Kelly, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Brad joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Brad, you're on the air with Senator Mark Begich.
Thanks, Steve. Good morning, Senator Begich. Thanks
yes.
for taking the call.
Yes.
Senator, recently the Environmental Protection Agency released the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment draft and has scheduled a series of tribal consultations with several villages throughout Bristol Bay. And much to our concern, many of these meetings occur during one of the busiest times of the year for our villages. Do you have any anything you'd like to talk about the watershed assessment and maybe the scheduling that the EPA has created for consultation?
Yeah, let me do two parts. First, on the scheduling, this is the first, at least I've heard of, maybe staff has, but if there's an issue with the scheduling, that they're picking times that are inconvenient for folks to participate because of the subsistence or the fishing season or whatever else that may be occurring in the region, we'd be happy to work with them to make sure there's full consultation as required under the president's executive order as well as administration order. So that's something we could follow up on. Second, on the overall issue, as you may recall, we actually, and I've had personal conversation with the director of EPA, that I did not oppose the idea of them going out there, gathering the information. As you know, there's no the thing with this issue, just make sure, I know there's very hard feelings on either side of this issue. There's no permit. That's a big problem. So what you have is both sides, huge propaganda wars, and may some of it be very accurate. Some also is very emotionally charged. So my view was, okay, EPA is going to gather this information. They're going to be able to lay out for the public as well as to the company, here's the issues and concerns on a large-scale project that may occur in the region. My position is pretty simple on this. I've said it ever since I was running and even before when I was mayor, that you can't trade off one resource for another in the case of a renewable resource like fisheries. But I know there are people out there who say, and I've seen some of the letters say, well, geez, I'm disappointed in you, Mark, that you're not allowing EPA to do a preemptive strike, meaning to deny a, I think it's a 404C permit. And my view is that's correct because there's no project yet. As soon as they pull the project, EPA has every right to do whatever they need to do. But you don't do that ahead of time when you're doing an analysis. And you know, I was asked by lots of people to write letters banging on the EPA. I didn't do that because the EPA did their job, which is in their prerogative and their rights, but they didn't do preemptive, and I was fine with that. But once the permit is pulled, the regulatory process will go into full steam, and the only federal end is really going to be EPA and BLM for access.
Brad?
Thanks. Thanks, Senator. You know, last week, some of us had an opportunity to attend a presentation by the Resource Development Council here in Anchorage, and we heard a pretty relentless story of the Sackett family, which really, I think anybody who's involved with development or business throughout Bristol Bay really ought to be concerned. Landowners, local businesses, whomever. The point is, you know, we're really concerned about large-scale government coming in and creating more regulation, making it more expensive to exist or to manage or operate a business or commercial fish in the area, let alone subsist. That's a pretty big concern of ours.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. And and I guess my comment is, again, to the broader sense, the EPA... You know, I met with some of the folks in the mining industry, and I said, hey, this is the first time the EPA has actually told you before you went in for a permit what your issues are. You should deal with it. If you can't deal with it, then that tells you the project is not viable from an environmental standpoint or an economic standpoint or both. But, you know, the Bristol Bay region is a wealthy, rich fisheries that we cannot jeopardize. It has not only a value to Alaska, but it's a national asset, and it's a worldwide asset in the sense of its sustainability of the fisheries there.
Brad, I want to thank you. Thank you for your call. It's Talk of Alaska with Senator Mark Begich as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, co-worker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org.
Talk of Alaska with Senator Mark Begich, and got one from Steve by email. It says, why it seems like the minority no longer needs to have a filibuster. If the majority doesn't have 60 votes, legislation loses. Can you explain why the minority isn't forced to mount a real filibuster so everybody can see it?
Yeah, I agree with you.
We're
in the minority of the majority that agree with you. That's the problem right now. We don't have enough votes to force this issue to the table. There's this kind of gentleman's agreement, which is actually has created more has Washington more dysfunctional than ever before because we have some people. On one side of the equation here that are just hell-bent on being disruptive and not making the system work. If you had to be down there for 30 hours and talk, I know senators can talk a lot, but 30 hours is a hell of a long time. And we could actually get some things done. But there's these quirky rules that some of these older members who have been there, honestly, I think too long, believe that they have to adhere to. And in this case, it doesn't make sense why we just, 50 plus. Now, if you want a filibuster, then, get down there and stay for 30 hours and debate, or as long as you need to filibuster, whatever it is. 30 hours is kind of the clock that ticks. But if you want to go beyond that, great. But they don't want to do it because it's not the, quote, gentleman's agreement they had. Well, they threw that out after a few weeks when they started abusing the rules. I mean, judges were never filibustered. I mean, district judges, not Supreme Court judges. I mean, district judges are now being dealt with here, and it doesn't make any sense. And the public says to us, well, I thought you were in the majority. I said, well, there's a new majority. It's called 60. So there will be an effort, once again, headed up by Senator Merkley and Senator Tom Udall, to push this rule change. And I have been supportive in the past, and I will be supportive in the future. I don't mind, if I have an issue, I don't mind going down to the floor and filibustering as long as I need to. But to sit around and put a filibuster on and then leave town, because that's what they do, so they can go do some fundraising or do whatever their special interest groups they want to meet with, and then come back on Monday and say, okay, I guess the filibuster's done, now let's vote, is the most disruptive and inability for us to get things done. You got me on a rant there, sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I want to try and get some in real quick here.
Sure.
One is transportation is in conference. Is something eventually going to be coming out of conference?
Yeah, I think we will be successful. In end of June, there's the deadline, and I'm feeling like things are moving. It's a conference committee right now. Congressman Young is on there, which I think is great because we have five issues we fought for. One was increased or stabilized and increased funding on our road system, Indian Road system, the Denali Commission, the ferry system, and then also the railroad. And on the Senate side, we picked off four of those. Actually, all of them had very positive outcomes. With the road money, we're now going to get more than we got the last 2 years. We'll get almost a little over $1 billion. Our Indian Road money, which, matter of fact, Fort Yukon uses it a lot. I'm using that as an example because I was just there yesterday to improve their system there, create less dust and dust control and a variety of other things. Denali Commission, we got a tweak in there to help it continue to move forward. The ferry system, we actually got recognition that it's actually a transportation network. It's not some leisurely vacation, you jump on a ferry to go see some island or something. It's actually a transportation network. We teamed up with the folks in Washington State. The next one is the railroad, and we are working with Congressman Young now. He's been very aggressive in the committee. The people believe it's an earmark, so we have to work around that to figure out how to get the right language, and we're working on that now, but I think by the end of this month. End of June, not end of May, but end of June.
Well, it's only natural that a U.S. senator comes on Talk of Alaska, and some people just want to say, thank you so much for the great job you're doing. Like it tends to happen. This one from Jeff.
We'll take those calls.
I'd like to thank Senator Begich for his help recently in assisting a small number of air traffic controllers who had transferred to Alaska at the end of their careers in recent years in acquiring their full retirement benefit. The FAA HR department needed some convincing that these controllers were entitled to the full retirement benefit, and Senator Begich was instrumental in making that happen. As one of those affected, I want to thank the senator personally. It was a small issue in the grand scheme of things, but it's a big issue for some of us. Thank you again, Senator from Jeff.
Well, it's the issues like that. We have a great staff here in Alaska and D.C. They do a lot of that legwork, and the reality is it's those issues. The gentleman believes, from our big scheme of things, it's small. Actually, it's pretty big because we know if we can solve those problems, it really affects someone right then and there. And if we can ensure that what was due to them, may it be in this case retirement or a Social Security benefit or VA benefit, whatever it might be, it has a huge impact. And we see it. I hear these stories off and on. And it's, and to me, those are the kids always ask me when I get interviewed by students, you know, what's the most fun part of your job? It's that, because we did something, and lots of times in Congress, things to go on and on. But here's a case where they laid out, we intervened, we helped, result occurred.
Well, if you manage to pull off that speculator thing and the price of gasoline goes down, you're going to have a whole lot of friends.
Oh, let me tell you, I would love that. Well, first friend would be my wife, who just filled up the car and told me.
Let's go to David, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Senator Mark Begich. David, time's growing short here.
Thank you very much. Senator Begich, I just wanted to thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. Thank you personally. Your office has been very, very great. I was recently in Iran for about 8 months, and we stayed to help my wife's mother. She had got sick, and we ended up overstaying her green card by a few days because of helping her mother's medical condition. And she's been stuck over there trying to get back home, and we weren't making any headway with anything. And I contacted your office, and it was just really, really great. And I'm getting ready to send the packages off now. She'll be home in a couple of weeks.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I'm glad we could help. And again, it's just what we were just talking about. These are the things that make a difference. And that is a bulk of our time we spend trying to help with. They again, in the big picture, people think they're small, but they are not. They are huge, and this is an example.
We got about 30 seconds if you want to say anything about the drone thing that you're going
the
to.
The UAV.
Yeah.
We have a forum, the unmanned aircraft vehicle. I think there's a huge opportunity for Alaska to be on the cutting edge of this, as was done on the Capstone project years ago, where now NextGen is a huge part of our aviation industry. Unmanned aircraft, unmanned vehicles are becoming a future, and I think Alaska has all the right assets, so we become the center of excellence in this country. If you want to test it, manage it, understand it, Alaska is a great place. We have the airspace to test it. We have military operations. We have the Kodiak launch, all the right things, and a great university to complement it. So this afternoon, we're starting our process of getting this coordinated, and I want to thank the legislature who put in $5 million at my request to seed this idea. And if we're one of the six sites selected in this country by the end of the year, I think we can show the rest of the country that we know what we're doing here. And people like Senator Stedman, Senator Ellis, Senator Hoffman, House Member Bill Stoltz were all instrumental in helping us get that allocation.
Thank you very much, Senator Begich.
Thank you.
Next week on Talk of Alaska, Jonathan Haidt, author of The Righteous Mind. Thanks very much to Dave Waldron on the controls, Josh Edge on the phones. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from the subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at AlaskaPublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.